Author, consumer advocate, and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader speaks at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Jamaica Plain, Boston, on Friday, October 30th, 2009. Ralph Nader is on a book tour for his first work of fiction, Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. As he states, the purpose of this book is to push the debate forward on issues of the day, particularly healthcare, by imagining another world as possible. Prior to his speech, as people gathered, and again afterwards while he signed books, the Cape Cod Trio, The Road to Raga, provided music that was a mix of popular protest tunes with an Indian-style flavor. This event was sponsored by the Jamaica Plain Forum and recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Reporters Project. Here now is Ralph Nader. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chuck, and thank you all for coming. You know, I've always believed Unitarians alone could turn their country around. And until they told me how few there were, which is, I think, about 160,000, I said, look at all they've done. Wow. Along with the Quakers. What does that tell you? Quakers, Unitarians, they never increased their numbers over 300, 400, 500,000. It shows you what connecting knowledge to action means. I suppose we have to add faith too, but someone, a Unitarian minister once told me that one of the mottos of Unitarians is one world at a time. But at any rate, this book is an attempt to jolt people into higher levels of expectation, imagination, and to envision real possibilities about what our country could become quickly. That's because the redirections that these billionaires who meet in a mountaintop hotel in January 2006 in Maui, Hawaii, are proposing. We have a lot of catch-up to do with Western Europe, a lot of social safety net, insurance, and many other things that Western Europe got. And we also have a lot of solutions on the shelf, energy, housing, public transit, education, so on. They're not perfect solutions, but they're a lot better than what's underground. And the gap between what's on the shelf and what's underground can be called the democracy gap. Another way of calling it is that people have given up on their own significance as shapers of their society from the community on up. And that's the easiest way to defeat momentums for a more just society, is to, through the educational system and all kinds of cues and antennas, to basically tell people at a very young age, you don't matter, you don't count, all you got to do is just try to get through life the best you can, because the big boys are running the show. And when I was 10 years old, I got a lesson from my father. I came home from school one day, and he asked me, what did I learn in school today, Ralph? What did you learn in school today, Ralph? Did you learn how to believe, or did you learn how to think? And never again did I sit in a class with a teacher that I didn't ask myself quietly, is this teacher trying to teach me to believe, or trying to teach me to think? And I met a lot of teachers at Harvard Law School and Princeton who tried to teach me to believe more than they tried to teach me to think, even though they talk about analytic skills. There is an ideology that pervades every minute of our lives, and we either absorb it and accept it unquestionably and move along its norms and boundaries, or we break through. We understand what invention does in technology, inventors, the cotton gin, and the electricity, and so forth. We're not as good as in getting us to reinvent our future and our social institutions. So I've written a lot of nonfiction books, And so has Bob Kuntner and William Grider and Jim Hightower and Gloria Steinem and Barbara Ehrenreich and Cornel West and lots of people. And we do have to confront the reality. In the last 20 years, there have been more so-called muckraking books exposing malfeasance and crime and government and business. There have been more documentaries. This is the golden age of documentaries. Just consider how many documentaries have been put on the criminal invasion of Iraq and the Iraq war and occupation. And after a while, you have to ask yourself a very tough question, which is, why isn't anything changing? And the reason why anything is changing compared to Silent Spring, which launched the modern environmental movement, and other books in the old days, is that the doors are closing in very sophisticated and not sophisticated ways on civic values and civic pursuits and civic programs that are supported by a majority of the people in this country. And single-payer health care, full Medicare for all, is an example of that. Majority of people support it, majority of doctors and nurses, and it's going nowhere. And the Congress, the Democrats, and Obama took it off the table until some intrepid souls that challenged the Senate Finance Committee with Senator Baucus a few weeks ago and stood up and dragged off in handcuffs. But it tended to agitate the single-payer effort around the country. But it essentially is off the table in Washington. Imagine a majority supported change in a health insurance system that gives you your free choice of doctor and hospital, replaces the private health insurance companies whose principal way of making more and more profit is to avoid the sick and deny benefits, and put it in the hands of full Medicare, public insurance, private delivery, which would save 45,000 lives a year, which are lost because people can't afford health insurance to get treatment or diagnosis in time. That's a figure in a peer-reviewed study just came out in the Journal of Public Health by the Harvard Medical School trio that have been studying this, Wallander, Himmelstein, etc. And it's not on the table. I've never seen a thing in Washington like that. I mean, I've seen majoritarian positions be defeated. I've seen them get congressional hearings. I've seen them get some measure of respect. But I've never seen a situation where the President of the United States says he believes in single payer, and the Democrats, for the most part, except for the Blue Dogs, say they believe in single payer, but it's not practical, it's not going to happen, and take it off the table. What are we left with here? So frustration, of course, tends to either produce demoralization or creativity. And so I wrote this in fiction. If I wrote this in nonfiction, nobody would believe me. So I had to write it in fiction. And the story starts in September 2005, right after Katrina. And Warren Buffett was worth $50 billion, widely respected in the business community, who wants taxes raised on the rich like him and wants to preserve the estate tax, as Chuck Collins was at the core of that effort, organizing the rich in that way. And he's sitting in his living room and he's watching day one after Katrina, day two, day three, day four, all these poor people and their families streaming north, east, south, no water, food, shelter by the roadside. And he can't stand it anymore. He hires very quickly a convoy of trucks with supplies and public health workers. And he goes down himself, straight from Omaha, Nebraska. And he's passing out all these things and directing the operation. And the word up the road passes that a billionaire from the Midwest is coming to help, when FEMA and the government can't get their act together. And he comes on an extended family, and the grandmother grabs his hands in gratitude and says, only the super rich can save us. And that haunts him all the way back to Omaha in his car. And he decides he's not going to leave his $50 billion money in a foundation after he passes. He's going to go to work now. So he selects 16 other very rich people, many of which you know, and William Gates Sr., Ted Turner, Phil Donahue, Peter Lewis, Barry Diller, and others. And he brings them to this mountaintop hotel in Maui, And he sits down with him, and he basically presents where he's at. He says, I'm not the same person I was last year. I'm not interested in a foundation sometime in the future. And I'm not just interested in charity. I'm interested in real change and taking power and putting it within the people's grasp in a deliberative process at the community level. And they were carefully selected by him so that they had roughly the same public philosophy. So they weren't fighting over, you know, which this, that. They did, on page 76, you'll see the seven redirections that they agreed to. But here's what they really come down to. Before they leave that hotel in Maui, they're going to give 1 year total time. They're going to assume that that's the last year on Earth for them. And they're going to put billions of dollars. And they're going to get and find the best, the smartest community, neighborhood, regional, national leaders. And they're going on two tracks, the civic momentum of civic organization, mobilization, and the political. They start a clean elections party. They have thousands of lecturers going all over the country. At one point, they were talking to 1 million people a day, personally. No screens, no text messages. They do not ignore the Elks, the Women's Clubs, the Kiwanis, the VFW, the American Legion. They go into the neighborhoods, and they start a People's Chamber of Commerce to bring in medium and small-sized businesses who do not want to be represented by the existing trade groups, U.S. Chamber of Commerce and National Association of Manufacturers. They find a 32-year-old wonderkin whose name is Luke Skyhigh to run it. As February, March rolls around, they each move out without letting anybody in the country know that they're coordinated. They each move out on their own particular missions. Joe Jamail, the trial lawyer, devotes millions of dollars to reviving small claims courts, clinics, and law school students trained to show people how to go into small claims courts, which are now being used by bill collection agencies. They're hardly used by tenants or debtors. And this generates hundreds of thousands of cases against big corporations who have never been sued before in small claims court, and they don't quite know how to handle it. They start a sub-economy. They buy a business in every sector. They buy a real estate business, a bank, an insurance company, auto dealership. They buy a dry cleaning establishment, a bill collection agency, to put forth best practices and irritate the conventional ways of doing business and expose them, and also to get intelligence feedback, because all these trade groups were getting together in New York and Washington to counterattack. So there's a real power collision that comes up here. This is not philanthropy in terms of charity. This is social justice shift of power movement, and they know it. And because they're successful business types, for the most part, they know how business operates. They know their weakness, their ego, their pride, their hubris, you name it. And as such, one of their first challenges was how to get millions of emails. This is being circulated now, just so we can all stay in touch, the clipboards, by the way. And so they got plenty of money to put one-minute ads on TV all over the country. The question is, how do they get people's attention who are saturated with all these ads? So they find a very colorful macaw parrot whose name is Patriotic Polly. And Patriotic Polly starts every ad with the cry, get up, don't let America down. Get up, don't let America down. Well, they get 13 million emails after a few weeks. Do you know why late evening news and always has to have an animal story if they can? That really grabs people's attention. Patriotic Polly actually plays quite a role later in the book. But once they get these emails, they hire 400 recruiters and they start sifting, because they get a lot of press, a lot of excitement in March, April. They start sifting millions of resumes and requests and interviews, because they know they got to do this top down, bottom up, and they've got to do it broad, and they've got to do it deep, every congressional district. They want a prevalence that far exceeds H.R. Block, which has stores in 6,000 places in the country. And they have the money to do it. And then they go to their peers and they develop their own epicenters and they start collecting money from their peers. You know, money collects money. And they have all kinds of ways of looking at civic mementums and techniques, strategies. They learn from the best, and they're underway. And I'm not going to continue to indicate how this all turns out, but if you read this book, and you have to read it and get absorbed in it, this is not a book that can be summarized by the Reader's Digest, because it's all in the details. I don't want people to think there are any magic wands here and they sort of go like this and they get what they want and they beat the bad guys. I want people to read the book and ask themselves, given the predicates of smart, elderly people who have nothing more to do but to make this a better country. It's all on domestic issues. They're not interested in accumulating big money. They want to look at their grandchildren, great-grandchildren in the eye proudly. And they want to leave something behind, and they don't want to see their country decay further. And they're willing to put billions of dollars in. And they're top-down, bottom-up. Once you accept that premise, ask yourself if there's anything in this book that couldn't be real. Tom Peters, who wrote this bestseller, In Search of Excellence, in the 1980s, sold millions of copies, has a comment on the book where he says, this is a piece of fiction that I'd love to see become nonfiction, which is why I wrote the book. And the genre of utopian fiction has atrophied in the last several decades. Russell Jacoby, who's a sociology professor from Southern California, wrote a book 10 years ago called The End of Utopia. By that, he was criticizing academics for not putting forth visions of what could become possible. They're into equations and social science, regression analysis, and so forth. And that was quite impressive, that book, because until recently, the word utopia to me was something like a commune or science fiction. And actually, in literature, it was societies getting themselves to levels of humanity and justice so that people can fulfill their life's possibilities. And so I read Thomas More's Utopia, which started it all in the 16th century, and it described an existing utopia in a faraway land in the Pacific, and the person from England had traveled there and came back and was describing it. And then, as Chuck was saying, there's Bellamy's Looking Backward. Sold a million copies, by the way. It excited all kinds of people in the populist progressive movement of those days, the most fundamental reform movement we've ever had before it petered out. And Eugene Debs, one of my favorite political figures, used to refer to it because it showed what could be. Not pie in the sky. What could be if there was a more adequate redistribution of power and then wealth in that sequence. And not wealth that people don't deserve. It's wealth that's overdue for their hard work, which they haven't been receiving. And in this country, we have a huge evidence that one out of every three full-time workers in this country makes Walmart wages. $7.50, $7.25, $8, $9, $10 before deductions. And the head of Walmart last year made $10,000 an hour. Walmart's CEO makes more before lunch on January 2 than 90% of Walmart workers make in a whole year, individually. And that's not the highest paid executive, as you know. So we're dealing here with nothing like dramatic anticipated penury for the super rich. We're dealing here with long, long back pay. And one of the working women who are in this book, she saw on television all of what they were doing, and she developed the motto for the campaign, which was in the book, "What's the big deal? We earned it." And what does that tell you? That tells you that she had an expectation level that was raised by what they did and overrode what she deserved. In other words, it wasn't that she was asking for something, you know, maybe she didn't deserve. And that's a very important psychological position to be in. We have the lowest expectation level of any people in the Western world, hands down. Eugene Debs, at the end of his glorious career fighting for working people in the 1920s, was asked by a reporter the question, "Mr. Debs, what is your greatest regret?" And Debs looked at the reporter and said, "My greatest regret?" Mind you, this is a man who would take a train from the East Coast to speak to an open field in Chicago, and 200,000 people would show up. He said to the reporter, "My greatest regret is that under our Constitution, the American people can have almost anything they want, but it just seems like they don't want much of anything at all." Now take that to 1945, end of World War II. The U.S. is the colossus, full employment, rich, powerful, astride the globe. Western Europe is devastated, cities destroyed, countryside destitute, 50% unemployment, hunger, people roving in bands trying to get scraps of food. With a little help from the Marshall Plan, which was a way to come back and provide contracts for our suppliers. Here's what they did. Through their multi-party system, not some two-party tyranny that eliminates competition by ballot access barriers and other harassment. Through their multi-party system, which allowed for coalitions for small parties, like the Green Party now in Germany. Through their stronger trade unions, through their stronger consumer cooperatives, they demanded and received for all their people universal health insurance, paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave, paid daycare, decent public transit, good labor laws, 4 weeks minimum paid vacation for everybody, tuition-free university, and on and on. 64 years later, the big winners in World War II have none of these for the people, all the people. The Republican Democratic Party did not deliver in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and we're still giving them the benefit of the doubt and voting for the least worst of the two. And when that happens, they don't need to smash the door down at 4 a.m. with Gestapo-like tactics to suppress the masses. We do it to ourselves. The reporter for the New York Times, Lou Uchitel, the labor reporter, wrote a book on the workers who lost their jobs in communities where multinational U.S. companies closed factories down, shipped them off to communist and fascist regimes abroad who know how to keep their workers in their place. And he came back utterly astonished at how many workers who lost their $20, $30 an hour jobs blamed themselves. This is what market fundamentalist ideology does when it gets in people's brains at a very, very early age. And that's all we're exposed to in the schools, and we're exposed to it on television, and we're exposed to it with Horatio Alger stories. And this is also what happens when we are told in so many ways that we can't fight City Hall. We're raised to believe, not to think. We're raised to obey, not to challenge. Look at our school systems. I remember once I was in the third grade And the teacher started teaching us about the local public library. And I raised my hand, third grade. And I said to the teacher, "It's not a public library. It's a memorial, private library." And she said, "You keep quiet," and put me on the dunce chair. You know, you don't have to sit on the dunce chair to know that when you come home and your parents say, "What'd you learn today?" and you say, "I learned that Columbus discovered America." "Really?" my father said. "I thought there were people on the other side waiting to receive them." Columbus discovered America. The myths that we live by and we learn by. And unfortunately, our dreams, the definition of the American dream is material wealth for individuals. I was raised in a family where the American dream meant justice for all. The last words of the Pledge of Allegiance, with liberty and justice for all, not for some. And that's what this book tries to provoke. It shows that there's a lot of people ready for change. There are a lot of people who know the fundamental redirections for a more decent society that are long overdue. The polls show it. The talk, the conversation. But they don't have the money to get it underway. And progressives and liberals, they don't like to talk about that. The Greens think money is dirty. So they field Cynthia McKinney as their presidential nominee last year, former congresswoman, most recently defending Palestinian rights in Gaza. You know how much the Greens raised for her? $200,000 nationwide. That's the difference between people who are concerned and people who are serious. The Greens are not known for being impoverished. I've been to many, many a Green fundraiser. I've never met anybody in shreds. They're doing pretty good. But they're not serious, with very few exceptions. They're not serious in fielding candidates. That's true. For the liberal progressive movement is in a rut. We've got people writing great material, proposing great reforms, and every 4 years they knuckle under to the Democrats because the Republicans are worse. Therefore, the Democrats don't have to give them anything. They just turn around and cater to the corporate pull on them. In this book, there are two tracks, the political and the civic. You can't have one without the other. You have to have civic movements to build political movements whose candidates know where they're coming from. They know where they're coming from, like in the old populist progressive days in the farm country when they elected senators and governors and representatives. For quite a while, they knew where they were coming from, and if they didn't, they weren't coming back. In this book, there are a number of ways that they deal with the lack of civic motivation, which I think is the biggest problem in our country. People are very demoralized. They're very discouraged. They get their hopes up. Obama, Obama. Now their hopes, you know, are sliding, as if anybody should have been surprised. Washington, D.C. is corporate occupied territory. We have a corporate government in Washington more than any time in the last 60 years. The doors are closed. Everything that I and others accomplished years ago, you could not do today. You couldn't get a hearing. You couldn't get a bill passed. You couldn't get a president who'd sign it. The corporations are smothering Washington as we speak with 2,000 drug industry, health insurance lobbyists. And there isn't one for single payer. The health insurance companies are spending $1 million a day on Congress, a day. The single-payer groups haven't raised $100,000. So there's a mismatch, isn't there? What happens when social justice movements fail when you, in your own civic assertions, city hall, developers, hospitals, whatever, and you lose. Don't you say, if only we could have gotten some more press on the late evening news, or if only we had more organizers, if only we had more influential people making calls that we couldn't get through to politicians, if only, if only, if only. That's why many of you have the makings of a practical utopia story, because you're willing to learn from your losses, raise the vision as to what is needed in terms of resources, money, to put into effect what is already existing. Good strategies, good ideals, good intentions, tremendous consensus in this country about basic future directions. I hope that you'll agree with Leslie Stahl, who read this book on her vacation, 60 Minutes, Leslie Stahl. She wrote me a letter saying she thought this book is engrossing, creative, and funny. And I said, I'll take all three, because it's pretty big. I insisted on large print because I want older people to read it. There's also dialogue showing common ground between liberals and conservatives, not liberals and corporatists, liberals and conservatives on some pretty important issues. And there's also techniques that are used that some of you will reminisce. You remember years and years ago, some of the older people here, the paper boys who were in downtown business districts selling newspapers and shouting, read all about it, read all about it. Well, they hire over 1,000 paper boys and paper girls to do this all over the country. When you have the money, you can do a lot, right? All right, now let's apply it to today. Suppose 10 or 15 billionaires of enlightened advanced age, and there are some, suppose they got together and they said, we just can't have a country that doesn't have full Medicare for all, that doesn't displace the perverse economic incentive of these health insurance companies who compete with one another over how many people they can deny benefits and loophole the rest, and they put $1 billion into it. And $1 billion represents probably 3% of their net worth, maybe 5%. And they fan out and they get the smartest, toughest organizers and unemployed organizers all over the country. And they learn from history about what works, and they innovate, and they deal with mass media, and they excite people. 18 months, we get single payer. That's my best guess. 30% of the Congress is already for it in private, if there was a private vote, and 83 have actually gone forward in the House, signed on H.R. 676. Obama says he's for it, but it's not practical, which is a code word for meaning the corporations are too powerful. Now, that's $1 billion. Suppose you're interested in the horrendous prison policy and prison situation. Do you know how much money's behind prison reform? A couple $1 million in foundation grants. You've got these private prison corporations that spend that in a weekend on an incentive convention in Las Vegas. What if you're interested in some other cause? Think of your causes. Ask yourself, do a majority of the people support this kind of change? If the answer is yes, you're in accord with Abraham Lincoln, who said if you have public sentiment, you can do anything. And then ask yourself, where's the money? Warren Buffett gave over $30 billion in stages to the Gates Foundation. You don't think he could put $1 billion in if he wanted to for single payer? What about expanding renewable energy really fast so we don't fool around with 1, 2, 3% increments over the next 20 years? And we really expand job production by retrofitting buildings for energy efficiency. What if some of these rich people put $1 billion and turning Congress around into real fundamental priorities here, not weak and easily evaded or corrupted measures that are now winding through Congress, like cap and trade. It'd be different. It just goes on and on. If we don't have conversations with these people, and you've got them in Boston, you've got them in New York, they're all over, the super rich. There's a discussion between Paul Newman and Bill Cosby in the book on the difference between dead money and live money. And they were pretty excited because this money was live money. The vast amount of money is dead money. It just makes money from money or loses money from money. It doesn't affect real life of people. Trillions of dollars there. A society that has more justice doesn't need as much charity. We're losing the charity race. You can't even provide people who are hungry with the surplus food, the harvest, food harvest groups, empty pantries. We're on a treadmill with charity. We have tons of charitable groups doing good work. They can't make it. We have to ask, not can we have enough soup kitchens? We have to ask, why do we have a society where there's hunger and poverty? And what justice does, it goes to the causes. And that's what these programs are designed to do, to go to the causes. And if we go to the causes, we get a gratification that's unheard of in our daily experience. Old Daniel Webster once said, the great work of human beings on earth is justice. And there's no greater gratification. Without justice, there's no liberty and no freedom. Marcus Cicero, in ancient Rome, defined freedom in the best way I've ever heard. He said, freedom is participation in power. By that measure, how much freedom do we have? And furthermore, we're a society that knows far more than it applies. I mean, I'm staggered by the number of practical solutions on the shelf, sometimes working beautifully in pilot projects, agriculture, industrial recycling, educational attainments. And they're not diffused. They're just feature articles for the Boston Globe. They're not diffused. There's no engine behind it. There are no resources behind it. And while the super rich are setting up huge multi-billion dollar foundations or giving a billion here and a billion there, they need to redirect some of that money into these social justice movements. And I hope some super rich will read this. Chuck knows how to reach a lot more than I do. Somehow they view me in a different way. And Chuck has succeeded in getting rich people to preserve the estate tax and a lot of other things that are on his agenda with your help. And we just have to up the ante in this matter. I think having these super rich people in their advanced years, 70s, 80s, 90s, allows us to break the stereotype that we apply to all super rich people as self-indulgent, narcissistic, myopic, golf in the afternoon, two-hour lunches, leisure in their retirement years. There are super rich for whom age changes. It changed their perspective, the way they want history to view them. But you know, they're amateurs too. Most of them don't have a clue how to make fundamental change. And they'll put more and more money into soft philanthropy, which is on a treadmill. Because if we don't deal with the causes, we're going to have more need for charity and more poor people and more sick people who aren't treated and more diabetes and high blood pressure and youthful obesity through the fast food industry and all the things. More over-drugged people, over-application of drugs. Every day you read these stories in the New York Times and elsewhere. And that's what we have to recognize. If we stereotype the super rich 100%, we're missing out on something. Some of them are as enlightened as we like to think we are. Some of them remember where they came from, dirt poor, and made it big. And some of them think that they never make it by themselves, no matter how rich they are. And that's what Chuck Collins and William Gates Sr.'s book's about. William Gates Sr., the father of the number one rich man in the world, Bill Gates, came out of World War II. He got an education with the GI Bill of Rights. And then he goes on and starts talking about all the public investment that facilitated him in becoming a very prominent corporate lawyer in Seattle, Washington. So let me just leave it at this. It doesn't work if this book does not generate an expanding conversation with you and your friends. It doesn't work if you think you know what this book is slightly about. This book is designed to stimulate your imagination far beyond what's in this book, because you're more than me. No one is as smart as everybody. This book is designed to stimulate your contacts. Say, yes, I do know someone I had a discussion with 5 years ago, and I can extend it. This book is designed to jolt people out of their routine and their rut. Because no matter how successful people are, they almost end up in some kind of routine or rut, and they can't get out of it. It's sort of like nothing fails like success, and they plateau, and they don't have that burr under their saddle to keep them dissatisfied. And far too many of us still grow up corporate. Even though we try to break through and grow up civic, our upbringing and our schools get us to grow up corporate. We have no idea about our commonwealth. We don't know what the American people own, so they control it, like the public airways, public research and development, public lands. It's not taught in our schools, not much taught in law schools. We just grow up corporate, and even if we fight it back and try to open up, and so we can think more independently, the stuff keeps coming in on us, and it keeps coming in on us. So where we open up one window, another one is closed on us. And that's why we have to say to ourselves, any functioning democracy has got to have commercial-free zones, or it can't function. When commercialism, uber alles, stomps on civic values and displaces them, as it's the commercialization of childhood, the commercialization of organized religion, the commercialization of politics, corporations are planning everything. They're planning our education future, our political future, our electoral future, our environmental future, our genetic future. Monsanto owns patents and gene sequences, our own human gene sequences. They're planning everything because corporations don't obey the phrase, enough is enough. That's not their makeup. If you ask Lockheed Martin, when is enough and enough in terms of selling the government fighter planes, they wouldn't give you a number. It's always more. That's why every major religion in the history of the world urged its adherents not to give too much power to the merchant commercial classes, because it's a single-minded motivation that tramples other values that are in their way. And commercial-free zones means that there are certain things that are never for sale. Government should never be for sale. Elections should not be for sale. Childhood should not be for sale. Our posterity should never be for sale. Education should never be for sale. And it's just the reverse of what's happening. So I hope you'll read this book, give it as gifts, and I hope you'll write your own practical utopian story from your own experience. Don't think you can't do it. I didn't think I could do it. But after you lose so many battles, you got a huge tank in your mental reservoir about what it takes to have won, what it takes to turn it around. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we have a robust New England discussion, I was raised in Connecticut, so I know what town meetings are about. I just want to have one of our fine organizers from Buffalo, who's been all over the country with us, just say a few words about the book, etc., and then I'll be back for a discussion. His name is Matt Zawiski. Now let me have Matt just say a few words, and we'll be back. Thank you.